There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
You are in Little Steven's Underground Garage with the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations throwback. Remember to follow and subscribe, rate and review. My guest is singer, songwriter, musician, and record producer Butch Walker. In the latter role, he's responsible for producing the recent Green Day album, Father of All Mothers. Our interview first aired Friday, August 26, 2016. And in it, we talk about his life growing up in Cartersville, Georgia, sneaking out to the Etowah Indian Mounds at night, how he started playing music at the tender age of 8 on drums after he saw Kiss on their Love Gun tour, that being his rock and roll epiphany. We also talk about his early bands, his career as a producer, and his solo career, which resulted in the release that year of his album, Stay Gold. The title track served as that week's coolest song in the world. So let's hear some of that now, followed by my talk with Butch on our Coolest Conversations throwback, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Standing outside a Dollar General, another MLK Boulevard.
My guest today on our Coolest Conversations is Butch Walker, famed recording artist, songwriter, record producer. How are you, Butch?
I'm doing well, man. How you been?
I'm doing okay. I'm doing excellent. So happy to speak with you today, a fellow Georgia boy. And you were from Cartersville, sir. Georgia, right?
I grew up in Cartersville, which is about 45 minutes north of the big city of Atlanta. And I guess, I was there till the day I graduated high school, and the next morning I left for Los Angeles. And I lived out there for a few years and then moved back into Atlanta with my band at the time, and basically, called Atlanta home for almost 20 years, I guess.
Well, growing up in Cartersville, did you ever have to explain to people that no, Jimmy Carter was not from there?
Yeah, everybody, that was the misnomer. It was like, you'd say Plains, Georgia, and people would be like, what are you talking about? He's from Cartersville. So, no, not pretty much, couldn't have been further from the truth.
Well, so I'm from the Atlanta area, and we made a couple of field trips to the Etowah Indian Mounds. And I know those aren't too far, these cool Indian mounds, sort of, you say, pre-conquistador era, a culture that was going on there. And they're not too far from Cartersville. I have to wonder if, like, when you were a teenager, did you ever slip out there and make some mischief?
Oh, my God. Right when you mentioned Etowah Indian Mounds, that's all I could think of was smoking pot, taking beers out there. Probably might have, had a few sexual relations at the Etowah Indian Mounds, but not on the Indian Mounds. That would be sacrilege. So, we were very respectful of the mounds themselves. They were, you didn't want to walk up the sides of them or anything like that, because it could dig up possible artifacts and bones and things like that. So Beautiful, beautiful setting, though, out there by the Etowah River. And I used to ride out there all the time. Some of my best memories of listening to rock and roll records was being in high school and skipping out at lunch. I skipped out at lunch every day, got my 76 Comet, and would ride with the tape deck blaring, you know, everything you could imagine rock and roll, and just ride up and down these dirt roads up there by the Indian Mounds by myself, just cranking music as loud as that little shitty Krako stereo could go.
When did you start playing guitar?
I started playing guitar when I was about 8, 9 years old. I started on drums, but I had a problem sitting down. I was always very antsy and always wanted to be up front and be the ham. And so, you know, drums didn't really do it for me because you had to sit down. And I was always in front of the mirror with a guitar, you know, just like trying to fake Pete Townsend and Jimmy Page, and most notably Ace Frehley, because what happened is my parents took me at my begging to see Kiss in 1977. I was 8 years old. They were playing at the Omni Atlanta 2 nights, New Year's Eve being one of them. So you can imagine what that was like at the height of their just bombastic pomposity. Everything was just, it was the Love Gun tour. It was so over the top and so insanely, you know, like for a first concert for an 8-year old, it's like going to outer space, man. That was like going to, it was like going to another planet. It was like the circus sucked in comparison to that. After that, you know, like I couldn't be impressed by anything after seeing that show. There was so much visual stimulation. So the next day I started pursuing music, and guitar was dear to my heart.
So your family very supportive of your music endeavors?
Well, you know, it was hard in Cartersville because it was very, you know, it's very much a conservative Bible Belt kind of a town, you know, classic Southern American town. And, you know, it kind of felt a little bit like the Footloose movie where like you weren't really encouraged if you were a kid by your parents to pursue rock and roll or listen to rock and roll, because, you know, if I had a dollar for every time somebody would come up to me when my hair was growing out, you know, saying, "I bet you play that devil rock and roll, that devil music." And, you know, you see hearing stupid stuff like that all the time. You know, I think my parents, they were not like liberal hippies by any means. My dad was, you know, he grew up a hardworking, you know, blue collar man. And my mom, a good old Southern belle. And, you know, they just both were very, they were understanding, I should say that. They were understanding of it. You know, they kind of knew that because my cousins had the musical bug early on that lived in South Carolina, and I was very much influenced by everything they did. You know, they were very impressionable for me because they were a couple of years older than me, and they were cool and listening to all kinds of like hard rock and stuff like that, and I was into it. So they didn't stop me, and I think that's the best part. I think the best thing that happened to me was the compromise when I started playing clubs and venues. I started wanting to play nightclubs when I was like 15, 16 years old. And so, you know, that doesn't sit well with a lot of parents in a small town. So, you know, I think I'd already made my mind up what I was going to do because I was really, really accomplished at guitar by the time I was 15 years old. And I had a lot of bands wanting me to join them that were touring and, you know, could make a little bit of money, you know, instead of working a dead end, you know, burger job, you know, in Cartersville. And so my mom and dad came up with this pretty genius, simple thing, you know, solution of saying, if you will just finish school and not fail, you know, just pass, we'll let you do whatever you want, you know. But that's, you know, I think they thought that I wasn't going to be able to pull off both, where I'd get home at 3 a.m. from playing three sets a night and then get up and go to school and still have good grades. But I did it despite everybody. So I like ended up having actually pretty good grades when I graduated, because, and I did it by the skin of my teeth because I was really tired every day. But, you know, that kind of gave me that fire, you know, that I needed to fuel me to get to it. So, I appreciate them actually in hindsight more than ever for actually, like, you know, not stopping me.
Well, yeah, you were working on 2 degrees at the same time, your rock and roll degree as well as a high school degree. I first became aware of you from The Marvelous Three. I only recently found out that you were actually out here in L.A. prior to that with a band called South Gang. And a couple of those guys stayed with you, the Marvelous Three. Now, I've heard South Gang referred to as both a hair metal band and a hard rock band. Is there any difference between the two?
Well, I think we were more hair than hard, you know? I mean, I think our idols at the time, even though it was like immersed in that scene of like, you know, call it what you want, glam rock, hair metal, you know, all that, that was... We were in the middle of that because we were 18, 19, and that's all we knew when we grew up in Cartersville. And the rest of those guys were from Rome, Georgia, which was even further north away. But, you know, the only thing we ever heard and the only thing we could pick up on the radio was like the hard rock, you know, hair metal stations that were playing everything that you can imagine was getting played in the late 80s. You know, we didn't get an education of cool underground music till we moved to L.A., but, you know, because we didn't know anything about it. All we knew was, like, what was getting played on the radio, which was great because it was everything from you know, John Cougar and Bruce Springsteen to Aerosmith and Guns N' Roses. And so, like, we're like, okay, well, we're just going to do that. And so when we moved out to L.A., you know, culture shock obviously hit us, but, you know, I think our music was way more probably along the lines of we wished we weren't by any means, but we wished we were the next Aerosmith. But we paled in comparison to that, you know.
Well, in fact, when that so you're living in L.A. and you guys put out a couple of albums and then that kind of fell apart and you came back to the Atlanta area. Were you like really sort of down on the whole music thing, business industry thing, or sort of relieved to be out of that and onto something different? What was going on in your mind when the South Gang thing fell apart or ended?
Well, I guess I realized that I was always going to have the bug to move on and move onward and upward. I was never satisfied, and that's a blessing and a curse, you know? But one thing that's great about it is that the minute like you're faced with any adversity as far as like what this music scene's in trouble, this band's in trouble, well, then we move on. Let's do something different. Let's do this other thing that we're really into right now. You know, instead of going, well, we've got to stay doing this same thing or else the 14 people that work at the record store are going to be pissed if we change it, you know? And it's like, I don't give a shit about that. Like, if I gave a shit about that, I'd be dead in the water 20 years ago and be tortured to the point where I would be too scared to put out records, which is what a lot of people, I think, do because they get so wrapped up in that. Not me, man. You know, I mean, I appreciated everything, all the bands and artists that grew over time, you know, and kind of dabbled in everything and pulled from the underground. And, you know, it was Bowie and Prince and a lot of bands, a lot of groups did that. And, you know, even Elvis, Costello, you know, and Presley, you know, they all, none of them really did the same record twice, if you think about it. I kind of liked that. And I think that's what, I don't know, for better or for worse, that's why I'm still here, you know, making records. So,
well, you know, that's very well spoken because that kind of describes your solo efforts. You know, after Marvelous 3 was finished, you released your solo debut the following year, I guess it was 2002, Left of Self-Centered. And now today your 8th solo album is out, Stay Gold. Tell me about the new album and like where, when you recorded it, but tell me all about it.
Well, okay, so the record actually I did before that, Afraid of Ghosts, that was the one I did with Ryan. We did that one together, and that was, I'll rewind a little bit and kind of tell you what happened there. You know, my father passed away 3 years ago almost, and he and I became very close, and he became my biggest fan and supporter over the years, even in, you know, in the days when nobody gave a shit. And just he really stepped up as a dad and as a friend. And I needed it, you know, because there was dark times. And, you know, just when he passed away, it hit me really hard, as you can imagine it would when you're close with your pops. And, you know, just everything kind of changed inside of me. And I think my brother-in-law said it best, and he said, you know, you never become a man until you lose your dad. I felt like this whole script had changed. And so I ended up writing this whole record that was pretty much an homage to my father, which was Afraid of Ghosts. And it was a very mellow kind of a very sad kind of a record, you know, and I'm very proud of it. And Ryan helps me produce it. He's kind of, that guy. He knows sad records, and I love his music. I love his records, and we were both admirers of each other, and he really helped me get that record out in the rawest form that I could ever do, because I was really couldn't produce myself at that time. I was kind of a mess. Mm. And then, I went out and toured on it, and it was cathartic, and I played every night and cried every night, and it was just one of those things that finally on the last day of the tour, that was it. I never groveled over it ever again. And it was that was a successful moment for me. Mm. And so whenever I started writing again for maybe another batch of songs for a new record, which would be Stay Gold, everything that was coming out was very nostalgic, but with a kind of a celebratory tone to it, very celebrated. And it felt like the transition and the natural progression to the next record and chapter in life would be to make a record that was just this big, like, celebration. It's like waking up the next day, and clearing the fog, and that's kind of what this record feels like to me, for lack of a better way to describe it.
We took a listen to the title track, Stay Gold, a couple of minutes ago. It's our coolest song in the world this week. What can you tell me specifically about that song?
Well, I just think that one was it kind of brought me back to growing up in Cartersville and hanging out at the local game room arcade at the end of the street with some of these kids that, I never really thought about it at the time, but growing up, I realized, guys came from some pretty unfortunate situations at home and didn't have any friends. And, that was kind of like that was their stomping grounds. And, I always gravitated towards these guys, because these were like the guys that were in all the movies I liked growing up, were the outsiders. And I just kind of started rolling with this theme almost based around, the S.E. Hinton story, The Outsiders. And I started kind of thinking, I think I'm feeling this whole, I related to that growing up. I was not the popular kid. I was not the soap with the good hair and the good clothes and the nice car, expensive girlfriend. I didn't have any of that when I was growing up. I was definitely identified more with the greasers, and it just kind of started coming out of me, and that song ended up being kind of an homage to that, I think. And, obviously the tagline saying, in a world so black and white, stay gold, I just feel like, if anything, more than ever in this day and age and this time, that felt like something I should probably say a lot,
Yeah. Well, at the end of 2005, you're like named by Rolling Stone as like producer of the year, and you've worked with, everybody from Pete Yorn and Weezer, Bowling for Soup, to Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and the Donnas, a bunch of others too. How did you start getting work as a producer?
Well, it was, it was kind of a lark. I didn't really, if you would have asked me 10 years ago if I was going to be, making a living producing other people's records and writing some of their songs and that type of thing, I would have said, no, fuck you, man. I'm going to be playing on stage the rest of my life, and I'm never going to sit behind a recording console making other people's records, just my own. But it just happened, I started it goes back to Marvelous 3, whenever that song in the late 90s became like a brief top five hit at like alternative radio at the time.
Yeah.
It just, the stars aligned, I guess. And people started coming to me and asking me like, well, who wrote that? Oh, I did. Who produced that song? Oh, I did. Where'd you record it? In my bedroom, and so I started getting asked by people to do that for them. And one thing led to another, and here I am. That's like half of my days and half of my year is spent in studio working on people's records. But I love it. I love it. It's one of those things where if I can balance it, which I think a lot of people don't, once they start realizing they can make a living because the money maybe is better, they give up making their own music, and they end up not making their own records, and they end up just stopping being an artist. And I don't think I could ever do that. Like, I got to do both.
I want to ask you about that. It's because you've produced such a wide range, pop, country, rock, punk. Is there any genre of popular music that you don't like? Is there any genre that you haven't worked with that you want to?
Well, yeah, I mean, for the most part, I grew up a musical mutt, and I guess I just learned to appreciate the good in all genres, because to me, and I've said this a lot to people, it's like there's good and bad music in every genre. And there's really bad pop music, clearly, and there's really good pop music, and there's really bad country music, but there's also really good country music. And I mean, shit, you know, there's, you know, for metal and punk, even, you know, it's easy for a lot of people just to say that all that is good because it's loud and fast and, you know, whatever. But that's, I don't know, some of it I really don't like and some of it I really love. So I enjoy both, all aspects of it. You know, all aspects of music. I don't know. I think there's definitely a line I'm going to draw. Maybe the Florida Georgia line. I will not, you know, I don't want to, like, there's not a lot of that music that I really enjoy, like the modern bro country I don't really care for. And, you know, I'd be lying if I said I was into, you know, modern like dance or, you know, EDM or any of that stuff. I mean, that's just to me, like, I don't really, I'm kind of a little bit old fashioned where I still want to be able to work at it when I'm producing it a little bit and maybe use real instruments, God forbid.
Well, you've worked with both genders quite a lot in the recording sandbox. Who's easier to play with, the boys or the girls?
Well, that's a loaded question. And and to be honest, it's really there is no answer for that because
well, that's a good
answer. I've worked with some really bad and really good from both sides. And, you know, I think that's one thing, too, is like for a while it seemed like I was getting called a lot to work with a lot of, you know, a lot of female artists. And I grew up with two older sisters and my dad was gone a lot. So I had nothing but girls around the house and I was the youngest out of the three siblings. So I'd get my ass kicked by a girl. if I didn't watch it, I had to learn how to respect them growing up, or they'd like throw a pot and pan at my head, you know, and that happened several times. But I think more than anything, that might have just given me, I don't know, maybe I can get along and I can you know, there's a certain technique with certain people, and believe me, there's just as many guys that are divas as there are girls. So it's the playing field is wide open.
So you are out on a tour now in support of the new album, Stay Gold, is available today. And you play tonight, the 26th in Philadelphia at the Theater of Living Arts. Have you ever played there before?
All the time. That's one of my favorite venues. I've been playing there since I was, since I was 22, 23, I probably played my first time there. So, it's a pretty legendary venue and I love Philly audiences too. So
City of Brotherly Love got a lot of love for Butch Walker.
Yes, sir.
Oh man. You know, we need to take a listen to another track from Stay Gold. And here in my neighborhood in East L.A., Northeast L.A., I do a lot of my shopping at the Super King. And they got the Mexican Coke in there. And I'm telling you, it tastes better. It tastes better. You know, maybe it's the real sugar. I don't know.
It's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Well, I read somewhere that the genesis of Mexican Coke, that song, is from your experiences in L.A. Now, is that true?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like it's a metaphor, you know. I mean, I kind of based it on this teenage, you know, young, like, you know, sexually starved teenage boy who is just who falls in love with every girl that walks down the street, especially older girls. And so he's like infatuated with this Latino girl who's also a prostitute and stripper, and he's enamored with her. She's got tattoos, she's got a gold tooth, and but she's super hot and he's really into her, and he's half her age, but, like, you know, it's every movie I ever saw when I was growing up in the 80s, so of every kid, you know. So it's like it ends up him just referring to her, you know, like, just as a sweet soft drink, you know.
Well, you know, there's nothing more classy than a big old gold tooth. That is always So before we take a spin with a Mexican Coke, thanks so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations, Butch.
Yeah, I loved it, man. Thanks.
All right. Right now, here's Butch Walker from the brand new album Stay Gold, serving up some Mexican Coke in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
When she was 20, I was maybe half. Had a gold tooth and a smoky laugh. And I remember being somewhere where my mama when she walked by. She had a brother that would stare me down. It ran with them dirty boys in a bigger town. Had a tattoo of his mama and a tear coming out of her eye. He made all the other honeys look so bad. Everything I wanted and nothing I'd ever had. Mexican Coke, Mexican Coke. Baby, so sweet, made me wanna show. Come on, come and put your sugar lips on me, honey, I gotta know.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.